Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yeah, Dear Science time, thanks to MOTAT. All right, first up, the renewable energy storage problem. Now, can you just talk us through what the problem itself is first before we talk about the solution?
Sure. So I think we're all familiar with renewable energy sources, different types of ways of generating electricity without generating lots of pollutants and things like that, greenhouse gases. But the problem is most of these involve sunlight or wind or tides or waves or whatever, and therefore they don't always go 24/7, and when they don't usually match up when people actually use electricity. So the sun's not shining at night when a lot of people obviously use electricity, and the wind may not blow all the time and things like that. So electrical power companies need to find a way to store the power that they've generated so they can sort of cover the bits, the times when it's not being generated. And there are several ways to do this. So one way is just to build a big load of batteries. And I think Tesla did something like this in Australia recently. A couple of years ago, they installed this massive battery installation, which helps the utilities cover the sort of the down periods. And that's fine, except the efficiency of batteries means they are extremely, it's going to be extremely costly to do this sort of thing. And you're only really ever going to get a few hours worth of storage at most. Yeah. So a better option is to convert the electricity into fuel, into a fuel that can be converted back again as needed.
Okay.
Not generating pollutants or anything like that, but to be able to sort of store it as a fuel, and then so you're turning electrical energy into chemical energy, and then converting it back again. Oh. Yeah. And that's possible, and you can do this by using a device called an electrolyzer, which takes the energy in electricity, ideally from solar or wind or something, to split water into oxygen and hydrogen, okay? And hydrogen gas is a carbon-free fuel, and it burns in air and produces water. So that's your pollutant. That's the output, okay? And then once you've created your hydrogen gas fuel, then you need to convert it back into electricity, and use a fuel cell. And so the fuel cells in electric-powered cars and things, powered cars can do that. So fuel cells and electrolyzers are two sides of the same coin. Electrolyzers turn the electricity into fuel, and the fuel cells go back again.
So you need both.
But the problem is each of those use a different catalyst. Now, a catalyst is a substance, a chemical that speeds up a reaction. And these things don't work without their catalysts, okay? And you need a different catalyst to go one way than to go back again. And so a single device can't do both jobs. You can't put electricity in, get fuel out, and then put fuel in, get electricity out. To try and get around this, this has been the problem. So this is the sort of energy storage problem. Mm-hmm. You need these two big sort of different devices to do this one job. To get around this, researchers have been experimenting with a newer type of fuel cell, and this is called a proton conducting fuel cell. And it works in a slightly different way, and it's quite complicated. But essentially, what it is you have two electrodes, pieces of metal, separated by a membrane. Okay, and at the first electrode, which is called the air electrode, you've got steam, water, hot water, electricity, and then a ceramic catalyst, and that splits the steam's water molecules into hydrogen and electrons. The hydrogen goes through the membrane, and the electrons go through a circuit. Yeah. Mm. On the other side, this is the fuel electrode. The electrons that have gone around meet up with the protons, and there's a nickel-based catalyst there, and that makes hydrogen gas. Okay, in previous devices of this type, they work okay, but they're only about 60-70% efficient at splitting water, and a lot of the energy is lost to just heat, which dissipates. But recently, some chemists in Colorado in the U.S. have built a new type of alloy, ceramic alloy, a new type of catalyst, that is up to 98% wow. efficient, which is a big leap. And then when they run their setup in reverse, in other words, when they're taking the fuel and converting it back to electricity, it works extremely well.
So this is really a solution.
This is a at least a lab scale solution.
Right.
To this storage, sort of the storage and recovery of electrical power.
And that would be, but that's going to be a problem that's facing any type of renewable energy, right? They're going to have to figure that out.
Absolutely.
And so this is yet to be kind of tested on a mass scale.
Yeah, and I think the next step is to build bigger versions of this and make sure that it still works.
This will also cost countries, right? To kind of make
right,
this
and that's,
equipment.
That's the big driving factor. So instead of having two machines to do this,
yeah.
or two instruments
just
to do this,
be the one.
It's just the one. So the cost of restoring renewable energy then drops quite
okay.
a lot and makes the whole thing cheaper.
Oh, exciting, though.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. This story, not so exciting. I mean, it's a horrific story. We have all heard of Jack the Ripper. So why are we talking about him today?
I wasn't sure if people had heard of Jack the Ripper.
Oh, okay.
So I'm glad you have.
The name is fairly well known.
Pretty famous.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was a serial killer in the mid-19th century, I think. There's been a lot of work done, a lot of analysis and questions asked about who this guy was. So crimes were not solved at the time. And there's been books written, and a lot of studies to try and figure out who this guy was.
Is that why he is called Jack the Ripper? Because we don't actually know what his name is. I mean, I know that there are other reasons why he's called Jack the Ripper, but also just to, you know, we've named this person because...
That's a very good question. I don't know why he's
called
Jack.
Why is he called Jack?
Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but we perhaps have figured out who he is now?
Perhaps, although there's still questions. So... There have been several forensic studies looking at the DNA extracted from some of the objects that were found near one of the bodies. So there's a silk shawl, a stained silk shawl, was found next to a mutilated body of a woman called Catherine Eddowes, who was the killer's fourth victim in 1888. And this shawl was speckled with what they thought was blood and semen, and the latter was supposedly from the killer,
mm-hmm.
possibly from the killer. There were four other women killed in a sort of a 3-month spree around that time, and they haven't found the culprit, but they've done some genetic testing on this in the past, and people have been, unsure about the validity of the results. But anyway, in this report, they actually go into more detail into exactly what was done, and they've decided that the data point to a person called Aaron Kaminski, who was a 23-year-old Polish barber, who was living in the region in the area. And who was a prime suspect at the time, one of the prime suspects
okay.
at the time. So the police suspected him. But even despite this, critics say that the evidence isn't quite strong
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, that's
close
the issue,
case.
Right? Is if we start bringing out these names and actually perhaps it's not that person or
right.
Yeah,
but
it's
actually,
ages ago, eh?
It's 140 years ago now,
mm.
or thereabouts, 130 years ago. So it's actually quite interesting why they can't go into all the details. So what they did, they looked at fragments of mitochondrial DNA, which is the portion of DNA only inherited from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And this was retrieved from the shawl. And they compared that from living descendants of the woman who was killed, Catherine Eddowes, and living descendants of this Kaminski guy.
Right.
Yeah, and the DNA matches that of a living relative of Kaminski. And this is what they
okay.
They
so that's
found.
How they've made
yeah.
the connection.
And also, they suggest that the killer had brown eyes and brown hair, which is not really a distinguishing factor, but that's what they could figure out as well. But the problem is, the critics say, "Well, you haven't told us how exactly the DNA matches all the details
yeah.
about this." And the reason they say the authors say in the paper that the Data Protection Act in the UK. Is designed to protect the privacy of individuals, and it stops them from publishing the genetic sequences of living relatives of either
right.
of those people. Yeah, so they can't. So in their paper,
they
use a sort of a cartoony
it.
Way of describing how the DNA matched these modern day people, but they couldn't say exactly what specific parts of the DNA were the matching.
Would this be is this a case that, you know, people were studying because of the notoriety around Jack the Ripper? Like, are people going back and looking at, you know, unsolved cases and trying to solve them
time? Yeah, I think so. And certainly this is, you know, I grew up in the UK, and this, you know, people were always talking, or regularly talking about this case, and so it was. It was certainly in the public sort of.
But surely, because there would be many other cases that have been unsolved, and
I'm sure there are. This is just one particular one that gained a lot of notoriety at the time, and I think it was because it was such a gruesome set of murders, and they didn't ever find the culprit. Mm.
Okay, so moving on to the last story. This is annoying, to say the least.
Yes, frustrating, to say the least. Annoying, frustrating, disappointing.
We talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
The
first all-female spacewalk.
Yeah.
And we did mention how it was a bit late anyway. You know, like, why is it only happening now?
Yeah.
And now it's not happening at all?
No, it's not happening. No.
Why?
What's happening there?
So it's not happening. So it was scheduled for the 29th of March, and it was Women's History Month, and it was great, again, overdue, long overdue. Mm-hmm. But the plans for this have fallen through, and it's because, and it's such a terrible reason, but it's because the NASA, they don't have enough spacesuits that fit the astronauts.
Okay, I'll let you say the story.
It's just so fucked.
You're
literally, it's like, what, they just didn't plan to have some female astronauts? What is it that the suits don't fit?
Okay, so I can tell you what their excuse, all right? So one of the two women on the mission, is obviously now going to have to give up her place to a man. And this is because, so she thought when she was taken up to the ISS that a large size suit, so these apparently come in medium and large and presumably other sizes as well, but a large size suit would be fine. Yeah. Because they thought this because it had sort of worked okay on Earth or in training, and they thought, well, people actually get slightly taller and bigger in space because of microgravity. She's actually now about 5 centimeters taller now than she was when she launched.
Right.
Just in the space of a few weeks. So I guess your joints will relax and everything sort of stretches out. So they thought, okay, well, a large size suit would be fine for her. But she went on a spacewalk last week with a male colleague and found that the medium size suit was a better fit. Okay. And she wouldn't be able to, she just wouldn't be able to work as effectively in the large size suit.
Yeah.
So she said, okay, well, I need a medium size suit. They have one. All right. And it's easier to change spacewalkers than it is to reconfigure a spacesuit.
Oh, wow.
I'll just make a new suit.
Yeah. So this obviously has been met with a lot of disappointment,
especially for the woman that is going to now not get to go.
Yeah, well, she's going to do spacewalks,
but
she's not going to have this first. She's not going to be part of this all female.
Yeah.
Spacewalk. Yeah. So she's, I think next week she's going to do a spacewalk, but it's going to be a male female.
Yeah.
Thing, okay. Rather than one than two. So the woman who went last week, McLean, she was the 13th, only the 13th, which is still surprisingly low. Woman to do it. The other woman called Koch is the 14th woman. The first woman to do a spacewalk 35 years ago was Russian Svetlana Savitskaya. More than 500 people have been to space, but only 11% have been women. But these two women astronauts were both part of NASA's 2013 class that were 50% female. So I think the gender balance is improving.
Yeah.
Yeah, but sort out the suits first.
Just make them suits that fit. Yeah,
okay.
That would help.
Oh, all right. Let's leave it there. Thank you so much, Marcus, for coming in, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.